Continuing in Mitzvah Shinun 350, which is the Mitzvah of Erchin or Arachin, which is the special way to donate to the Beis HaMikdash, which is you pledge someone's value, and not their actual value if they were to be sold as a slave, but a set series of values that's explicit in the Chumash that depends solely on the person's age and gender and not on any other factors, no matter how, robust this person is, but rather totally just on age and gender with absolutely no other thing factored into it. So he mentioned last time that there's this concept called sidur, that you make an arrangement. That means, let's say someone makes a pledge of an erech to the Beis HaMikdash and cannot afford to pay the whole thing with liquid assets. So first of all, there's a concept that you assess his assets and you can reduce the debt slightly due to that, but if he really cannot afford anything with liquid assets, then you take his possessions and sell them and make sure he can pay at least the minimum required portion of the erech. So there, the sidur, which is the arrangement, means that you don't just take everything, every last possession that this person has, but rather you leave him some essentials, like a basic set of clothing, like food for 30 days, like his basic work tools that should be able to get back on his feet, but his other possessions, which are deemed to be even slightly unnecessary, would be taken by the temple treasury and sold in order to pay off this debt.
Would there ever be a time when even some of those essentials would be used in order to raise the funds necessary?
What do you mean? Even the essentials? No, never.
No, okay.
No.
Good.
Yeah, no. No, the essentials stay with him. So the question is, what's considered essential? There are differences of opinion among the poskim as to what's considered to be essential. And one of them is the Sefer Chinuch brings that if he was a Talmid Chacham, so you give him the Masechta, at least that he is working on, that he is learning at the time. And so that would be, the Sefer Chinuch mentions that this is a proof that the Sfarim are Klei Umnus. Right, so he says, I'm sorry, so this is part of the Klei Umnus. So he says this is the reason that the student has to bring the book to the teacher. The teacher is not required to bring his own Sfarim, because it's part of the learning procedure. In other words, it's part of the Right, okay. So if it was the teacher's responsibility, says Art Scroll, to bring his own book, books of Torah would certainly be considered tools of the trade for him and would be protected from seizure. So, in other words, not going to be a tool of the trade. If it were a tool of the trade, then the teacher would have to bring his own book and the student would not have to bring the book to the teacher, and therefore it wouldn't be seized. Whereas according to most authorities, so you do seize all the books besides perhaps the Masechta that they're currently learning, because they're considered to be extraneous property, even though you're supposed to learn. Nevertheless, it's not considered to be so essential. I mean, even things that are halachically suggested or recommended, such as Shabbos clothes. We don't leave the fellow. You leave the fellow only one set of weekday clothes, and he's going to have to suffer and wear them on Shabbos. So the same thing, too. So you don't leave the masechta that he's working on, and the rest of his farm you don't leave. The rest of his farm you take, because they're not considered to be the basic essentials of his trade. Whereas if books were considered to be the basic essentials of his trade, then you would know that the student wouldn't have to bring the teacher, because it's expected that each professional has his own set of tools. You wouldn't, in other words, if you're a carpenter, so the student doesn't have to bring the apprentice carpenter doesn't have to bring the master carpenter his hammer, his plane, whatever. So that's something that's assumed that the carpenter is going to have on his own. So it'd be the same thing regarding the books.
Would it make sense in this type of situation, let's say that the person owing the money to the place in English, has a set of very valuable tools or sfarim to substitute those very valuable sets with something of lesser value, but still it would enable him to continue with his profession or his learning and so on, but with a set of tools which would be of lesser value.
That's assuming there's enough money to do so. In other words, if all he has to sell is his expensive set of books, he has this huge, fancy Ozva Hadar Shas, so there's no other possession to sell. But if you sold that, then there'd be enough money to pay his debt to the temple treasury and enough money to buy him a simple set of books. So yeah, sure. Yeah, definitely you would do, that. Yeah. That's why it even says that if you have a very expensive set of clothing, so you sell that, and then even if there's not enough money to pay the debt, see, he still has to have, you know, a basic set of clothing, so you sell the expensive set of clothing, and you buy him a cheaper set of clothing.
Okay, I mean, it makes sense. It was just a question in my mind also whether the person would be valedic, and, you know, that under the circumstances, it would be bullshit for him, whether you want to put someone in that position.
Well, he put himself in the position. He shouldn't have made the vow that he had no means to pay. So, and even though you do have this concept of Sidur, that you don't take every single last strap of possessions, nevertheless, you know, it's he did ultimately he did put himself in this position. Umasha Amru Zichron Levracha, what did the sages tell us? Shenishalin al ha'arachin v'ha'domim kederech shenishalim al shar nedarim behekdeshos. That you could undo your vow by means of hataras nedarim. You go in front of the of a bezdin or in front of a yochid mumcha. We have a concept that we don't really exercise anymore, that if there's one person who's really considered to be an expert in the laws of vows, then you don't need a bezdin of three, but rather you can go in front of this one person and you can make hataras nedarim, or you could have three regular people who are not such such big experts. So either way, you go in front of them and you say, you know, you explain why you think you should be released from this vow, what circumstances changed that if you had known at the time that you made the vow, you wouldn't have made the vow. So if you explain that properly, so you could be released from your vow of an erech or a damim vow. The same way that any other vow works, although it's considered to be a little bit more of a chutzpah than other vows, because here you pledge the Beis HaMikdash and now you're trying to undo it. So in theory, in extenuating circumstances, it can be done, but it's very, very discouraged.
Would this Hataras Nedarim be done in the way that we're doing it currently, usually at a certain time of the year, or would this have been possible at various times, depending on when that chov was due?
Well, the Hataras Nedarim that we do now every Erev Rosh Hashanah, according to the Minag, probably really only covers the vows that you sort of forgot about and you haven't paid much attention to. But if there's a specific vow that you want to annul, then you have to, at the time, before you want to undo the vow, so you have to go in front of the Beis Din and you have to declare this exact what exactly the vow is and to undo it.
That could have been done at basically any time.
It should be done as soon as possible to the time that you would like to exercise the release of the vow.
A couple of years ago, I'm on the board of Mount Sinai, for my sense, and there's a woman on the board. She said, before we do this meeting, can I get three of you to be a Beis Din, because I made a neder to something about lighting an extra Shabbos candles because she forgot once, or something of that sort. And she said, you know, I shouldn't have, whatever. And so they did it. And it wasn't Rosh Hashanah or anything.
No, when there's a specific thing, you should do it as soon as possible.
The
Rosh Hashanah thing is just, you know, to cover your bases, basically. Okay. It's not really, it shouldn't be used in general to nullify specific nedarim. It also helps, you know, when there's some sort of, you know, like a suffix, like you're not really sure, you know, it can have the status of a nether when you take on a praiseworthy practice and you intend to continue, or you do it three times, then I consider it to be have the status of a nether. So if you're not really sure whether you had in mind, you don't want to, so then you can use the Hataras Nedarim of Rosh Hashanah. But if there's something specific that you really had in mind to take on as a neder,
then you're supposed to do a separate Hatharas Adarim for this specific thing.
That would apply to something that was voluntary. It's not like if you're a guy and you said, I'm going to daven mincha every day, you know, with a minyan or without a minyan, whatever.
Well, you could take, that would really be a shavua, not a neder, but okay. You could, you know, then you, if you don't do it, then you violate your shavua and you violate... You know, you violate the din anyway. So, I mean, yeah, there is, you can make a neder or shvuah to be mechazik yourself, to strengthen your observance of a particular mitzvah. But,
okay, so if you're a woman, you say, I'm going to daven ma'ariv every day, in addition to whatever else I'm doing.
Right, that's subject to Tarzan Darm, sure.
Yeah, okay.
But don't go to Chaim Kanievsky if you want to be matur that neder, because he holds that women are obligated to daven ma'ariv every day.
Really?
That's yeah. Interesting. I think Rav Soloveitchik also held that. But that's not one of his psukim that really caught on in the centrist modern Orthodox community. Everybody goes so gaga over everything Rav Soloveitchik said, and they would latch on to everything. And they like his fun and exciting psukim. But this is one of my big gripes, that his when he had big chumras that impose on people, so they tend to ignore. Yeah, so Rav Soloveitchik, like you pointed out to me once, you were in a shul, so that Rav Soloveitchik didn't say the extra paragraph in Ma'ariv Baruch Hashem La'olam, which like they don't say in Eretz Yisrael. That was added on later, so he didn't, you know, Vilna Gaon didn't personally want to say it, whatever, because they wanted to have not extra additions at that point in davening. So a lot of shuls they saw, Rav Soloveitchik didn't say Baruch Hashem La'olam, we're not going to say Baruch Hashem La'olam, but... Rav Soloveitchik had very serious chumras in other areas, in Hilchos Erevin, in Hilchos Nida, in Hilchos Tfila, Hilchos Avelos. He had very, very, very serious chumras, and that they when it doesn't get them out of some something they would otherwise be doing, so then they're not so clean and keen on all these things. So that's why I'm not so, in my opinion, shul should be doing the regular, standard Jewish. Stop. Practices rather than these things also are the things he did privately and not necessarily for public consumption. Okay, yeah. Which is actually funny because there's a principle that I mentioned when we were learning about Avelos, which is halacha kedivrei hamekel ba'avil. There's a halachic tradition that we try to be as lenient as possible regarding the laws of Avelos, which he held, Rav Soloveitchik held, there is a basis for this, that he held that only applies to things that appear in the Gemara. When you have explicit disagreements in the Gemara, so our tradition is that we adopt the lenient opinion, but it doesn't apply to the opinion of later authorities. After the Gemara, when you have a difference about how to interpret it, so you don't necessarily go with the most lenient opinion. But most people assume that it's, even though maybe it technically applies to the stuff in the Gemara, nevertheless, the principle, it's teaching us an attitude we should be adopting toward the laws of Avelos, which is to generally to try to be lenient. Fine, so you can make a Taras Adarim regarding an Erech and a Damim Neder. V'amru gam keim shim hayu b'nichse amarech behemos o avodim umargolios. So if you have animals or slaves or jewels, v'amru atagorim imilokach le'eved ze ksus b'shloshim dinar mashbiach yo bo yoser mishishim. So I have a good investment for you. When you're selling off these assets to try to pay your erech. So he says, hey, this slave is a pretty good slave, but if we buy him some nice clothes to present him well on the slave market, he's going to fetch a much better price. Yeah. So do you wait to sell him in order to pay the erech or not? You have here a young animal, but if you wait to sell it for another month, it's going to be worth twice the price. Umargoli zoi malin osal makom ploni tishve mamon rav. So here, people perhaps are not so into jewelry. They don't want to pay so much money for jewelry. So they're going to offer you not so much money. But if you go to a richer city where people are really into jewelry, and you take it to this place, so people are going to be clamoring for this beautiful pearl. You're going to get much more money for it. Ein shomin lahem klal. You don't listen to these merchants. Elamochren akol b'makomam of a shaitan. You sell them immediately in that place and that time. Shenemar v'nasanes v'arkecha by yom hahu kodesh Hashem. You say you give V'erech on that day, Yuvah Perush Olav Shezer Kosum Lamin or Kol Davar Hekdesh Ein Mefarnes In Oso. That if you have something that's supposed to be given to Hekdesh, to the temple treasury, so you don't wait to sell it. Vein Mamtinin Lahem L'Yom Hashuk. You don't even wait to a market day, which is even just a couple days. Vein Molichin Oso Mimakom L'Makom. You don't take it from place to place. V'zer Kol She'ein Lach Bahem Ela Mekoman V'Shaitan Bilvad. You don't worry about it, you're worried something's going to happen to it, you don't deal with it, you just sell it now in order to pay off the debt as soon as possible to the Beis HaMikdash. So, right, you're speculating about the futures of a certain commodity is, yeah, absolutely. This applies to movable objects. If you need to sell land to pay off a debt to the temple treasury, Boker v'erev, achar kach mochrenosim. You announce their availability twice a day. They didn't have Facebook. You couldn't post that you're selling this thing, so who's going to give me a price? Right. Forget Facebook, newspapers, yeah. So v'achar kach mochrenosim. So you only sell it because then you need to, it's not like a movable object, so here, just sell it. There's, you need to figure out, you know, it's not going anywhere. It's not going to, nothing's going to happen to this land. I mean, it could, you know, basically, more or less. There's land isn't going anywhere. So you try to make sure as many people are aware, at least, of the sale as possible in order to be able to fetch the best price. Okay? You mentioned before, if it was really about lighting an extra candle for Shabbos, and that's a little bit off topic, but if it was really about lighting an extra candle for Shabbos, so that's not really a neder. That's a strong minhag that was already established in the times of the Rishonim, that if a woman forgets to light Shabbos candles 1 week, so then she has to light an extra candle, or some say bigger candles that burn longer, every Shabbos for the rest of her life. It was a penalty that was imposed on her because she left her family in the dark, basically. So in order to make sure she never does it again, she has to light an extra candle. So that's not really the subject of Hataras and Darim, unless you voluntarily accept upon yourself to light an extra Shabbos candle, which I'm not sure exactly why, but
I don't remember the details of the thing, but nobody challenged her on it. They got three guys.
But I would tell her. So there are poskim who don't agree with this, but most poskim nowadays, I would also advise women to do this. Feel that this only applies, this penalty to light an extra Shabbos candle, only applies if you have no light in your house on Friday night. Meaning, because the penalty is that you left your family in the dark to eat the Shabbos meal in the dark, you get penalized. But here, even if you don't light the Shabbos candles, there's plenty of light. There's plenty of electric lights. So this penalty would only apply if she managed to turn off all the electric lights before Shabbos and didn't light Shabbos candles, so her family was in the dark. So according to me, it's very, very rare nowadays that would actually impose this penalty on a woman that she'd have to light an extra Shabbos candle for the rest of her life. So that's why, if she would have come to me, this woman, I would have said, you don't need Hataras HaDarim because you're mistaken. You only need Hataras HaDarim when you know what you're doing and you accepted the neder, and then later on you realize that you regret what you did. But if you mistakenly thought, in other words, she thought, oh, I have to light an extra candle now for the rest of my life because I forgot to light Shabbos candles once. Mm-hmm. So now halacha says that I have to light an extra Shabbos candle. Okay. So if a few days later you go to your rabbi and the rabbi says, no, you are mistaken. The halacha doesn't say you have to light an extra Shabbos candle. So there you don't need Hataras HaDarim because you thought it was a requirement, but it really wasn't. A neder only applies when something you know is was optional and you would take it on voluntarily.
I don't recall the details of this.
Right.
But there a couple of people seem to be fairly knowledgeable about, I don't know, I don't remember the details of it, but mm-hmm. It was the only time I've ever seen anybody actually do
Hataras HaDarim.
The thing happens. Just two comments here. Well, one comment actually. First of all, it's pretty difficult in a time when your family would really be in the dark if you forgot to light Shabbos candles. It'd be pretty unlikely for you to forget to light them. But I don't know. Okay, but even so, on the other hand, have they no appreciation for how harried and harassed women are, and especially were.
That's why you need to be. That's why you need to be. They need an extra incentive to make sure they light the Shabbos candles.
No, maybe.
You're right. It's unusual.
Maybe the kids and husband have a little bit more.
Right. So if it's really a case of onus that the let's say she fainted, you know, 10 minutes before candlelighting time, and she was only revived, you know, after sunset, then that wouldn't apply. It means that only if she was negligent, and she didn't light the Shabbos candles.
The other thing about it is that, okay, you go to some people's houses and you see gazillions of Shabbos candles. Oh, it's the children and the grandchildren, you know. But, you know, your average person who you always see like two and all of a sudden you see like three, it's like a constant reminder to the public that you once forgot to light Shabbos candles. Is that nice?
Right, according to me, it's very rare that that would happen. But I would also say, personally, that even if that would have been the case, that a woman really left her family in the dark on Shabbos, then you don't actually have to light nowadays an extra candle. You could light an extra electric light, which is less conspicuous.
Or maybe use bigger candles.
Or you can use the option of adding more oil to the candles or using bigger candles, whatever type of candles you light. So I once went to someone's house for Shabbos, and she had tons of Shabbos candles set up. You know, I was like, she doesn't have that many kids, you know. So she says because if she forgot several times to light Shabbos candles. So if she would come to me now, I'm not her rabbi, but if she would come to me now, I would say, forget it. Go back to the. I would tell her that she's allowed to. That she was mistaken, and she would be allowed to, without a Taras and Darim, to go back to her regular number of candles without lighting these extra candles. Yeah.
Regarding karka.
Oh, karka. Yeah.
Karka would include, let's say, not only a field, but real estate property.
Any real estate, yeah.
It's very common these days to make an improvement to karka in order to get a better price. Would that also fall under the rubric of not delaying in order to give the what is owed to Beis HaMikdash?
Yeah, the only thing would be is only time, that you give it a few weeks, 60 days, whatever it says. 60 days to publicize it, to make sure that, you know, you get the best, everyone's going to come to the auction and get the best price, but there'd be no obligation to try to, you know,
improve the property.
Right, to try to construct improvements. Okay. Right, exactly. The Hoyle Tasa Le'inyali Yada and Inyan Sidor. He says, since we're already talking about this idea of making an arrangement for someone who owes money, Nichtov Kan, Masha Amr Zichron al Racha, Inyan Sidor Rivalchov. So what about making an arrangement? Forget about someone who owes an Erech to the Beis HaMikdash. But let's say you just owe money to someone else. Regular interpersonal loans. It's very interesting what the Sefer Chinuch decides to go on tangents about and write about length. Sometimes, you know, huge basic areas of the Torah, he just writes in one sentence, you know. And the laws of this can be found here. But, you know, here he's all of a sudden, he got excited about the laws of Sidur, so he's going
it's
on a whole...
It's very practical, because in terms of interpersonal relationships, it's something that comes up constantly.
Hopefully it doesn't come up to the extent that, you know, you owe someone money and you can't afford to pay the debt, so we have to start selling off your assets.
Yeah, but I'm saying it happens pretty often that people owe each other money, and for one reason or another, they're trying to get out of it or make alternate arrangements and so on. So it makes a lot of sense.
No, it is practical, but I'm saying a lot of other stuff that's perhaps even more common, the Sefer Chinuch, you know, writes about in one line, and here he goes in a whole essay, which is just interesting. So, the same way you make an arrangement for someone who owes an Erech, so too, you make an arrangement for someone who owes money to another person. And they go on a whole discussion about this concept, whether it's true or not. That the end of the story in the Gemara, it says that one of the Amoraim, Rabba Baravua, found Eliyahu Anavi in a Goyish cemetery. He was hanging out in the Goyish cemetery for some reason. Okay, the Gemara discusses a little bit more about that, but it's not related to the issue of the Balchov. Amar Lei Mahu Shiasadju BeValchov. He says, "What is the din? Do we make a sidur? Do we make an arrangement for a regular borrower or no?" But Rashi Zichron Racha V'Achirim Garsi Minayim Shiasadju BeValchov. So some say not do we make an arrangement for a Baal Chov, but what is the source that you make an arrangement for the Baal Chov? Meaning, what's the difference in the two Girsos? Kilomar dipshitale l'rabba baravua de mesadrin. In other words, according to the Girsa of Rashi, that it's minayin, from where do you know this? It means that it was obvious to him that you do make such an arrangement for a Baal Chov, for a regular debtor. And according to the other reading where it says, Mahu sheyisadju b'Baal Chov, that would mean that he was asking Eliyahu Hanavi whether or not you do it. Okay? So going with, again with the reading of Rashi, that it's pasha that you do do it, and he was just asking the source. So how do you know? And Eliyahu responds, Micha Micha Me'arachin. So you respond, you learn that they use the same lashon of Micha. Micha mi machu, that if he's too poor. Micha means to be poor. So it uses the lashon of mach by the arachin, and then it uses also the lashon of mach by regular debts, that when your brother will be poor and he will have a financial crisis with you, and you shall strengthen him. Dehainu halva, so meaning what is strengthening him? Meaning you should lend him money. You shouldn't take interest, but you should lend him money. If he's too poor to pay the erech, fine. So you have to the accepted interpretation is that you're supposed to make him give him a living from his erech, and that's the source that you're supposed to. Make the seder, make this arrangement for someone who cannot pay his erech, that you leave him some stuff to work with and clothe himself. So since the Elio says that you learn out from the same lashon, that it uses the same shoresh, mem vav chaf, both by the an erech and by a regular debt, so it means you have the similar arrangement, that you leave him some stuff and you don't seize all of his assets literally in order to pay the debt. All the immediate post-Talmudic authorities and the Rif paskin this way, that when somebody owes someone else money and cannot pay back the debt, you don't seize all his assets, but rather you leave him his clothing and a little bit of work tools. There are other Amoraim in the Gemara who recorded as saying that this concept is only by Erchen. It's only when you own Erech the Beis Hamikdash, but by personal loans, you don't have this concept of making an arrangement at all, and you literally seize every single asset of the person when he doesn't have enough money to pay back an interpersonal debt. Anu.
I'd like to ask you a question. Something I believe we learned with Rabbi Block, and perhaps Mr. Epstein might recall also if he was present. Question is this. I recall that he taught us that a community has a certain obligation to an individual, let's say it was a prominent individual and he was accustomed to a certain standard of living and things happened and he was no longer able to maintain that high standard, and the way that I recall, we were taught that the community has an obligation to do what is necessary in order for that individual to once again be able to live at the standard that he had been accustomed to. Would a situation such as this override that chiyuv from the community if he owes money for hegdish, and that arrangement of keeping that higher standard of living be disallowed or would be discontinued under this circumstance if that money is owed to Hekdesh?
Yeah, so that what you're referring to is when someone just goes bankrupt, basically, and used to be a wealthy person and now can no longer afford to live in the style, and it's very embarrassing. Then part of the requirement of tzedakah is to support this person according to the manner to which they become accustomed. Right. But that doesn't apply when it's his own volition and he...
That's what I was asking.
Yeah, he
so
right.
It does override. Okay.
Right.
Just a side, another diversion. This supporting him in style, which he always used to take a cab to work and now he never has to take the subway. I mean, that can be a big embarrassment to somebody. You know, and I get that to some degree you should support him, but at some point there's priorities. Suppose there's people in the neighborhood that are going without food, and you're paying this guy's cab fare.
Right. No, you're right.
It has to be some triage here.
Yeah, you're 100% right. You're 100% right. And probably a lot of times the community couldn't literally afford, you know, to keep a billionaire who lost his money, you know, couldn't afford to pay. Let's say he has an enormous mansion in Teaneck. So the property taxes there are very high, I hear. So, it's not a good use of communal funds when there are people who really don't have basic necessities to continue to pay his property tax. But as much as possible, as much as feasible, you're supposed to...
Or to, you know, help him get back on his feet, or a holding pattern, you know, the interview suit, that you know, whatever, and stuff
right,
like that.
Right.
I got no problem with interview suit.
Mm-hmm. Right. So even though there are rabbis who said you don't make an arrangement for interpersonal debts, Anu Eimlanu Ela Divrei Eliyahu Pikpok. He says, no, we paskin like Eliyahu Hanavi. Eliyahu Hanavi is a very major halachic authority, even greater than all the rabbis in the Gemara. So therefore, we paskin like him. Afal bi shematzanu Rabbeinu Tam, the shekosev kiman damar ein misadrin. Rabbeinu Tam paskin, not like Eliyahu. He says, well, he reinterprets Eliyahu's opinion, rather. So he says that Varyosev is Sifro of Acher Rabin Lahato. So Rabbeinu Tam paskins, like the other opinion in the Gemara, that when it comes to interpersonal debts, you do not make an arrangement at all, and you literally take every single possession that this person has in order to pay the debt. So nevertheless, the Sefer Chinuch rejects the opinion of Rabbeinu Tam as a Das Yochid, as a lone opinion. So you go according to the vast majority opinion, which is that you do make an arrangement. Gama Rambam, Zichrono Brocha Posach, Yishar Agonim in the Misadrin. The Rambam also paskin, not like Rabbeinu Tam, that you do make an arrangement for interpersonal debts. Umikol Moko, Afa Bikin Chosav, Dein Shleach Bezdi, Maniach Levalchov, Ela Kelim, Shei Efshar Belohim, Gomita Umatza Umashu Lavush. The Rambam says that the arrangement that you make for a debt is not as indulgent as the arrangement that you make for someone who owes an erech. So by an erech, you give clothes, you give food for 30 days, you give all these things. So the Rambam says that by an interpersonal debt, you leave the person who owes the money only with the absolute bare necessities, like the clothes on his back and the... his bed and sheets, but everything else you take. V'nirashis kiku l'rav lo markein k'sharab v'erik zed emakabel gabi shleich bezdin shomer v'mishnah hayushnal shnei kelim nota echad u'machzer echad es akar balayla ves amacharei shabayom velo manu klei ha'umnos. So he says that there is a mishnah in Bava Metzia that around this discussion where it talks about the arrangement for an interpersonal debts that says that when you take these collaterals, so you take his pillow during the day, because he's not using it then, you have to return it at night, and his plowing tool during the night only, because not using it at night, only during the day. So you switch off the collateral that you take depending on when he needs to use it. So since it says it doesn't include his work tools for his pottery wheel, if he's a potter, so the Sefer HaChinuch thinks that the Rambam learns from that even the work tools you would take for interpersonal debts, but not for an erech.
It's a dumb question. No, it's not a dumb question. If you're going to take his tools, his work tools, How's he going to make any money to pay back the debt? It's like debtor's prison.
Yeah, that's a good point. He would have to hire himself out for menial work in order to make the money to get the...
Yeah, and he might be able to pay it off faster if he kept his potter's wheel.
Yeah, okay, but the Maisa, he wants as much money, the creditor wants as much money now for the as he can get from the debtor, yeah. But the Sefer HaKhinah thinks that this opinion of the Rambam is not very oisgehalten, as we say in Yiddish. The Chayvan, the Kaim Alon, the Mesadrin, Bo Kederach, the Mesadrin, by Erech, and Shavimim, Bechol Dover. If we say that there's an arrangement by an Erech and it's by interpersonal debts and it's learned out from each other, so it means they have to be the same. You can't say, the Rambam can't invent that there's an intermediate category, that there is a more comfortable arrangement by an Erech and a less comfortable arrangement by interpersonal debts. That's got to be the same.
One more question.
Yeah?
Does the creditor,
mm-hmm.
does he have to enforce it this tough? Can he give the guy a break?
I mean, of course. Okay. I mean, for the Erech, no, but because that's the base of Mikdash, but for interpersonal debts, so...
No, I meant interpersonal.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. You can forgive a debt, of course, anytime.
Forgive a debt, yes.
Yeah.
Sorry.
V'fogav... Even though he doesn't, the Mishnah doesn't list the work tools. The Mishnah does not list every single possible example. It just means, you know, use these two examples of a pillow and a plowing tool, and the same thing applies to all the other stuff that would be appropriate to leave in the terms of the arrangement. Arrangement with a capital A. Uchlala de milsa lefianira v'muskam l'rov gioni ha'olam asher yotze lehem shem batara shemesajim al'chov kiderach shemesajim barachim b'shaveh. So he says, conclusion, the arrangement with a capital A is the same for an erech and for interpersonal debts. Ve'yishlam ha'ashis mochav yidivar gemara midel yo zachar tov kidechasvina. And as we said, this is very provable and supportable by the words of the Gemara and the words of Elio Navi himself. V'im tishal, you can ask a question. V'hechi misadrin lo ksuso. How could it be that when there's an interpersonal debt, that part of the arrangement is that you allow him to keep his clothing? Ba'ariam reba gemara mineva filu miglima de al kaspe. The debt can be enforceable even from the clothes on his back. What does that mean? It's like an exuba. If you go into weddings, this is...
The shirt off his back.
No, it says... listen to that exuba. One part of the lashon of exuba is this exuba is enforceable. Avafilu min glima de al kaspai. Even from the clothes on my back can be taken in order to collect money to pay the exuba. Efshar lomar de lashon guzma. I mean, okay, it's an exaggeration. It doesn't literally mean that you strip him in order to take the clothes. Inami migalima hachashuva biyoser. Maybe this is only referring to clothes that are very expensive. So you take his expensive clothes, but it doesn't mean that the clothes that he's tam wearing you literally remove in order to pay the debt. Take your pick of pronunciation. Now, there's a whole masechta in the Gemara that discusses these rules. It applies in all places and all times. A male and female can make an erech pledge. So, meaning that you, if you pledge the money, it becomes sanctified. Nowadays you shouldn't do it because you have no place to give it. You're just going to create problems that you have all this sanctified money you're lying around and it's no good. The first paragraph of Maseches Avodah Zarah. Too bad Marjorie isn't here. She's the Avodah Zarah expert. Not in the practice of Avodah Zarah, yeah. Ein makdishin vein marichin vein machrimin bizman hazeh. You don't sanctify things nowadays. Vim hikdish oherich ohechrim. So if you pledge something to the base of Mikdash, behema te'oker, a behema should be uprooted. What does that mean? Perus ksus v'chelem yirkavu. And if it's a fruit or clothing or vessels, they should just be left out to rot.
Most uchli matches yolichem liyam amelech. And if it's something that doesn't rot, such as a coin or a metal tool, then you should throw them into the sea. That they should not be usable. So don't do this. It's not smart. Don't do this. Ve'ezahu ikor. What does it mean when we say a behema should be uprooted? Animal rights activists, close your ears right now. Noel deles b'faneha v'hi mesa me'eleha. You lock it up and you let it die. Why? That's not allowed. The Gemara itself even asks, you know, hey, what's going on over here? There's Tzar Bali Chaim. You're not allowed to cause animals pain and suffering. So how do you do this? Well, A, it's a deterrent against people actually foolishly consecrating an animal nowadays.
That's for people who care about Tzar Bali Chaim. Some people, unfortunately, don't.
Okay, that's also true.
It wouldn't be a deterrent to
but the problem is that if you let it run around until it, you're not allowed to kill it actively because it's holy, and you're not allowed. You're a little bit stuck because, and you're not allowed to just let it run around and graze because then if somebody doesn't realize that it's holy and they start petting it and they use it to start doing their work for him, so that's strictly forbidden due to the prohibition of me'ila.
Don't do this.
Of using. For your own purposes, a consecrated animal. That's why this is pretty much, the only way to deal with it, which again is very, very not good. We strongly recommend against doing this for many reasons. This means if you consecrate it for the temple treasury rather than for use as a korban. So since it says in the same breath, you shouldn't be makvish, you shouldn't consecrate, you shouldn't make an erech. So you assume that this phrase is talking about all kochi berek habayis, stuff that's given to the temple treasury rather than used as a korban, like just like an erech, which is not used as a korban, it's given to the temple treasury. The afogav the amar shmuel barachin hegdish shavim manesh shechilo shave pruta mechulal. So Shmuel says that if you have something that's hekdesh, you can transfer its sanctity when it's koche berek habayis. When it's koche berek habayis, something that's given to the temple treasury, you can transfer its sanctity onto a small coin. So this also doesn't apply to hekdesh when it's talking about money that you consecrated for tzedakah. Because money you consecrated for tzedakah, you're supposed to do that. That's a good idea. And also, you don't have this way out that you take a small coin and you say, let's say you pledge $10,000 to tzedakah, and you're like, I'm not sure I really want to do that. So then you say, you take a nickel and you say, oh, all the holiness of the $10,000 that I designated for the tzedakah should be transferred to the nickel. That doesn't work. That works for... only for koche berek habayis. When you pledge something to the temple treasury, you could transfer its holiness onto a nickel, onto a small coin, because we have a principle, eino na lehekdesh. There's no... ona means that you misrepresent the price. So when it comes to God, so you can't misrepresent prices to God. So therefore, even if you give a small amount, that's also good. That's the same principle applies when you have meiser sheni. So you have the Maaser Sheni, which is the tithe that's given on the third and sixth year of the... I'm sorry, the first, second, fourth, and fifth years of the Shemitah cycle, which is eaten in Yerushalayim. So if you don't eat in Yerushalayim, so you could take a coin and you say, I transfer the holiness of the Maaser Sheni onto this coin. So it doesn't have to be worth the exact value of the Maaser Sheni, at least not B'dieved, because that's considered God's money, so there's no cheating God. It doesn't even mean you're not allowed to do this, to transfer the holiness, but if you did it, it works. That you're allowed to do this. So there's not a contradiction between these two rulings, that the animal has to be shut in the pen and just left to die. And the idea that you can transfer its holiness onto a coin, because one of the statements is telling you what the din is if you consecrate the animal. And one statement is telling you, how can you fix the bind that you've found yourself in, which is by redeeming the holiness of an animal, of the animal or whatever it is, onto a coin. The same explanation is given by the Rif in Masechas Avodah Zarah. The Ma'isi L'Hosam Tarvayu Ba'adi Adadi. He brings these two statements together. Let's say you, in the time of the Beis HaMikdash, you didn't give your Erech, or nowadays, if you didn't destroy the object which was consecrated, or redeem it on the smaller coin. You turned your back on God by failing to pay your pledge. And if three festivals passed, all three festivals passed after you made the pledge, before you gave it, you transgress the specific prohibition not to delay the payment of your vow. Some say if you don't give it immediately, you violate the prohibition to delay giving your vow. If you could give it immediately and you don't, then you violate it immediately. But if you pledge a korban, there's a halachic system involved. The korban has to be brought at specific times in a specific place. So by a korban, you don't violate this unless you delay till all three festivals have passed without giving your korban. But other stuff you violate immediately. The three regalim are not in order of whatever order you after you pledged it. So if it goes by Pesach in the beginning. So if you pledged it in right after Shavuos, clocks are ticking only at the next Pesach. So you would only violate beginning two Sukkoses after you made the pledge. Some say you never violate the prohibition to delay unless you delay it past the three festivals. By the gifts that you're supposed to give the poor from your field. The Gemara doesn't make this distinction between whether it's something that you have full authority to obligate yourself or not. So that would contradict the statement that says in the Gemara that stoka, you violate this the prohibition of delaying immediately. So the Sefer Chinuch says it doesn't really mean that you violate the prohibition to delay. Rather, it just means that you're obligated to give it immediately, but not that you violate the prohibition to delay. Okay, continue. Session next week.